All right. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you today. I have heard the most amazing talks that I've ever heard. I think your talk was incredible this morning. Thank you for giving and sharing your testimony. I just heard Michael Boris give a great talk. It's just humbling to be here before you. I think my resume kind of builds me up to a height that I'm not really comfortable with. As I was telling our board here of personhood, we had our meeting yesterday, I truly do consider myself a crooked pencil. I am like Moses, you know, who stuttered and felt that he wasn't worthy, and I really, really believe that. So I almost wish one of you were given this talk. But God put me here, and so I'd like to start with a quick prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Okay, so the talk I'm giving today is on compromising with abortion. And I'd like to kind of thread a theme on Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, and how he was able to explain the sense of immediacy that he saw for action in the civil rights movement, and why I think that applies to us today. I purposely left this picture here. It's my last year's birthday, and those are my kids. I don't think I would have all of my children unless I did the work that I do, and so I was able to get the right formation and reject contraception and have more children than I thought probably on my own that I'd be able to handle or anything like that. So I couldn't do this without my wife who's at home and without my children too. So I just wanted to mention that. Last time I gave this talk, I gave it last week, and I got through about a third of it. The first third is kind of the state of the pro-life movement, and it's not a pretty place, a pretty picture that I paint. So I want to try to get past the really pessimistic part so that I don't leave you all depressed. So I'm going to get started. Okay. Okay. I got a clicker. Should work. Thank you. Okay. So I'd like to begin with the very basic. When I was researching for this talk, I started thinking, and I thought, you know, what's an unjust law? Why do we in the personhood movement in particular consider laws that make any exceptions to be unjust laws? And so I have this little clip of different people that got together to read sections of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, and I'm going to start that off.
At first glance, it may seem rather paradoxical for us consciously to break laws. One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal, but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all.
Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust.
So our good senator is speaking the language of personhood, and he doesn't really make sense, doesn't understand what he's saying, because as you know, being from Ohio, he's 100% pro-abortion, and the key words of he's really just speaking the words of Martin Luther King, so it's really not, you know, no credit to him. But he says, any law that degrades human personality is unjust. So with abortion, you don't just degrade human personality. You have to completely abolish the unborn's human personality. You have, in order to justify it, you have to consider that they're not a person, that they're something else, subhuman. So again, the question is the constitutional right to abortion an unjust law? And we just saw that, you know, according to Martin Luther King's definition, I think we can all agree. I think we all know that here. I don't know if you've heard this argument from Roe versus Wade. It's the oral argument that the attorneys had with the Supreme Court justices. And it highlights the key that they're honing in during the argument and how the judges are seeing this issue. I think it's important that you actually listen to the words that they were debating.
It seems to me that it is critical first that we prove this is a fundamental interest on behalf of the woman, that it is a constitutional right.
Oh, yes, second, how about the fetus?
Okay, and second, that the state has no compelling state interest. Okay, and the state is alleging a compelling state interest.
Yes, but I'm just asking you, under the federal constitution, is the fetus a person for the purpose of protection of the due process clause?
All of the cases, the prior history of this statute, the common law history would indicate that it is not. The state has shown no...
Well, what about... Would you lose your case if the fetus was a person?
Then you would have a balancing of interests.
Well, you still have anyway, don't you?
Excuse me?
You have anyway, don't you? You're going to be balancing the rights of the mother against the rights of the fetus.
It seems to me that you do not balance constitutional rights of one person against mere statutory rights of another.
You think a state interest, if it's only a statutory interest or a constitutional interest under the state law, can never outweigh a federal constitutional right?
It would seem to me that...
So all the talk of compelling state interest is beside the point. It can never be compelling enough.
Okay. I don't know if you understand what's happening here, but when they're talking about compelling state interests, they're really talking about does the state have an interest in protecting the life or the property or some kind of interest on the opposite side of abortion, okay? And what Sarah Weddington, the attorney who was trying to legalize abortion, is saying, there's no compelling state interest there. And so the judge is saying, well, you know, so all this talk about compelling state interest is beside the point because you don't even think that there's a person. So, you know, it's all beside the point. It can't be compelling enough. Okay. And that sets us up for the next 45 years, which is if you're balancing the recognized constitutional rights of a woman who's in front of you, who's there, exists, is recognized with the rights of nothing, then the rights of the woman win every time, so it's a catch-22. You can never recognize the rights of this entity that doesn't even exist, and that's the tragedy of the pro-life movement, I think, is that we've tried to compromise with evil, and we've tried to work within a system that's set up to be a catch-22. We cannot win under Roe versus Wade, because the fetus is not a person, and the woman clearly is a person. So, any interest of the woman, whether it's and Doe versus Bolton, which was the other opinion that was delivered with Roe, basically laid that out in the definition of health, right? So if the woman claims that you know, this would put a strain on her financial situation, then that's enough of a compelling interest on her part to overcome nobody. There's no interest on this side. So really, it's a catch-22. It is abortion on demand. That some of the justices recognize that from the very beginning and made it clear. Unfortunately, I think the pro-life movement didn't fully recognize that, and we kept trying to work within this framework that's set up for us to lose every single time on every type of bill that we bring up that tries to abide by it. But there's a deeper problem here, and Roe versus Wade is not the problem itself. It's a result of a deeper societal problem. It's what I think Michael Voris was talking about in his talk. So I did want to mention something as an attorney. because in, I don't know if you picked it out, but in that discussion, Sarah Weddington and in the subsequent opinion, they state that the unborn child was never considered a person under the law and there's no precedent for it. They didn't have great legal research back in the day, but I think they had good enough research to pick out decisions like that from Chief Justice John Marshall, who stated that the words any person or persons are broad enough to comprehend every human being. That was in 1818, then in 1885, shortly after the 14th Amendment, U.S. Supreme Court held that when the preborn children in the womb were cut out of a probated will without proper representation in court, the rights to due process of the preborn child was violated. So that child didn't even have to be viable. The child didn't have to end up surviving. It was simply the child already had vested rights in the womb, and it's clearly in Supreme Court precedent. So really, it was all a farce. They ignored clear precedent. And there's two other cases, but really the precedent, the legal case there is very strong. And in fact, even liberal commentators, respected liberal lawyers will say things like Lawrence Tribe, who said one of the most curious things about Roe is that behind its own verbal smokescreen, the substantive judgment on which it rests is nowhere to be found. So it was really just an imposition by the court of a result that they wanted, and they were going to make it fit no matter what, and it's terrible legal reasoning. So going back to Martin Luther King, right, what do you do to overcome an unjust law? He had four steps that he was using, and he would say, first, collect the facts to determine whether an injustice exists. And that's key, because if you're talking about going against the established order, you want to try to avoid anarchy. And so you really have to do your due diligence, really determine that there is a legitimate injustice. You have to try to negotiate. You have to try to find peaceful solutions. We have a system of representative democracy. We can, you know, vote. It's a little harder with judicial tyranny, but you have to try to negotiate. In their case, in Birmingham, they went to the authorities. They tried to get some of these wrongs corrected. Obviously, they were told, you know, wait. We'll do this in the future, you know, but don't be troublemakers. And so the third one I think is super important. That's self-purification. And I think that's something that it doesn't matter if, you know, you're on the no compromise side, if you're on the more, you know, compromise with abortion to try to get as much as you can, even if it's 1%. I think we have to really look inside. It involves a lot of prayer. It involves, you know, self-purification. And they did that. Imagine the qualm that they had back in the day, having police brutality employed against them, having, you know, just terrible oppression, and trying to keep that group of people peaceful in the face of all that. That involves great self-control. And so that's a part of the self-purification. I experience it when I go to abortion mills. I have a really hard time going and praying at the mill because I get angry. It's something inside of me that I just can't stand there and watch this happening. And so I have to just, you know, pray. And honestly, I don't do it enough because I can't. It's too much for me. I need to do something. I need to, you know, be working. And in my mind, I haven't gotten to the point where I can understand prayer to be doing that. So I need to work on that. The fourth thing is direct action. So here's a part where Martin Luther King is talking directly about this argument of, you know, wait. This is something that we see in the pro-life movement all the time, right? It's wait, we need to elect a Republican Senate, Congress, president, and then we can have one more justice, right? And then they'll overturn Roe. So just, it's always wait. And we've had numerous Republican Congresses with a Republican president. In fact, I actually did this for the article in the Personhood book. I went in and I counted every single abortion decision since Roe versus Wade, and I looked at who had been appointed, by whom each judge had been appointed, Republican or Democrat. And it was something like 75 to 80% of the votes to retain abortion on demand were issued by Republican-appointed judges. So getting Republicans to appoint judges is definitely not, you know, the silver bullet to do this. It hasn't been in 45 years. I don't think it's going to be, and I'm going to explain a little more about that. But listen to this clip a little. It's 1 minute long.
We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. it must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see, with one of our distinguished jurists, that justice too long delayed is justice denied.
So, you know, how many of you think that we would be taking the action that we are and acting with the urgency that we are acting if, you know, one of our priests were being snatched every day and murdered, or one of our bishops? There's something in us that is causing us to not act with the urgency that we should with abortion, and this is always seen in this wait, wait, wait attitude. We're losing thousands of children every single day, and I don't think we can afford to wait. We need to regain that spirit that has been present in different points of the pro-life movement, but usually recedes when we hit an obstacle. We need to act like we believe that children are being murdered every single day. That is happening. We know that for a fact, and I think we need to act accordingly. And this is one example of this wait attitude. I'm a practicing, believing Catholic, and this was very painful for me because I participated in the initiative campaigns where we collected signatures for months and months to put these amendments on the ballot. We weren't able to move these things in some states like Colorado because we couldn't get legislators to do the right thing. They were all squishy, and so we decided, hey, we have this direct democracy approach. Let's go to the people. And so we got signatures. We collected them. And I remember one day I was outside the cathedral in Denver, and I was collecting signatures. It was rainy. It was so cold that the pen really wasn't working. And it just broke my heart when the security guard from the cathedral came out and told us we couldn't collect signatures on the sidewalk to do something that the church teaches us that we should be doing. And so, again, the statement that was issued by the Catholic Conference, basically, I won't read it, but it said, you know, wait, it's not the right time. Nothing has happened, of course, in Colorado since 2008. After 10 years, it's still not the right time. It's never going to be the right time unless we demand that it be the right time. So I do want to read the letter that the local bishops in Alabama sent to Martin Luther King. And because I think it sounds so hypocritical, and at the same time, it sounds so similar to what we hear all the time when we demand a stronger approach to ending abortion. They say, when rights are consistently denied, a cause should be pressed in the courts and in negotiations among local leaders and not in the streets. We appeal to both our white and Negro citizenry to observe the principles of law and order and common sense. So basically, shut up, sit down, and, you know, get in line. And thankfully, Martin Luther King said no. And they did have those civil disobedience protests, which ended in them realizing the full rights that had been promised under the 13th and 14th Amendments. So if abortion is an unjust law, I think we can all agree, I'm preaching to the choir, and it's constitutionally, it was wrongly decided, which I think even, you know, all the different stripes of pro-lifers agree, even some pro-aborts, then why do we continue to obey it? There's this idea that by rejecting the natural law and adopting legal positivism, the legal profession has in effect agreed to a complete moral disarmament. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand. Legal positivism is basically the idea that we have to obey the written law, right? When something happens, the Supreme Court issues their latest judicial tyranny opinion, you get all the politicians that we like coming out and saying, it's the law of the land, so we have to obey it, right? So that's the view that the law of the land is the end all. And our Declaration of Independence, the founding of this country, in fact, the foundation of our civil society is that there is a higher law than the man-made law. And that's what Martin Luther King was referring to as well. When there is this manifest injustice that's carried out through the letter of the law, then we have to appeal to our innate sense of right and wrong, and that's the natural law. And so this is from my my guru in pro-life law is it's kind of the theory that Dr. Charles Rice developed, and he kind of traced our problems with abortion back to the Enlightenment, back to the idea that we have to have a secular society. So God has to be out of the public square. And this was obviously adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in a very radical reading of the separation of church and state. So a faith-based argument is disparaged. It's not to be made. A lot of pro-life organizations have adopted this, unfortunately. And I'll name names. Students for Life, they discourage their people from making a faith-based argument. National Right to Life, I think, would discourage their people from making faith-based arguments. A lot of the big organizations say, you don't want to appear like a religious zealot. Forget that, you know, most of us are religious people. Most of this country is made up of religious people. And certainly the foundation of law and order in this country depends upon a moral basis that you can only reach from a belief in a creator. It doesn't have to be your Catholic doctrine, but you do need a creator, somebody higher than whoever has power, than the latest legislative enactment or judicial decision. So secularism inevitably leads you to moral relativism, right? The idea that there's no right and wrong. If you don't have a God, then there's no ultimate decider of what's right and what's wrong. It leads you down to moral relativism. Eventually, you have to replace God with something, and that it right now is individualism. It's me. It's whatever I want. And so we're in charge and not God. And here's where I would like to echo what Michael Voris was saying about the contraceptive mentality, right? We're in charge, and so we determine how many children we have. And since we determine how many children we were supposed to have, right, we don't allow God's hand in that, then when our contraception fails, which it does often, then we have to go to abortion. And then when, you know, old people kind of get to be a burden on our society, well, then we have to kill them off. And again, you can derive pornography, the acceptance of pornography from this. And of course, homosexual marriage, right? If sex is not for procreation, there's no right and wrong, then why shouldn't, you know, Joe and David get married? Why are we denying them this right? And so this is just to say that Roe versus Wade is a symptom. It's not really the problem. Abortion is a symptom. Again, it's a symptom of this broader problem. I don't want to, you know, paint a picture that says that, you know, all we need to do is pass this law or change the Supreme Court. We have our work cut out for us. And something that Dan Becker and the whole personhood movement has been very adamant is that abortion itself is not the only issue in terms of the threat to life. We have a lot of developing technologies, issues with IVF and the exploitation of assisted reproductive technology, the creation of human-animal chimeras, all sorts of issues that when you take God out, you have moral relativism, and the individual is your highest goal, the Epicurean principle, then everything else follows. So we have to correct all those things. I'd like to talk about why I think there's a problem in trying to solve this through lawyering. I am a lawyer, but I don't think we can solve this problem right now with our existing legal theories. We have usually our conservatives are described as originalists. They're almost all legal positivists. So they believe, you know, you just go by the very text of it. And the job of the lawyer and of the judge is just to interpret that law and to basically, you know, do whatever the legislature says. Let's see, this one here, this quote is important. My view is that regardless of whether you think prohibiting abortion is good or whether you think prohibiting abortion is bad, regardless of how you come out on that, my only point is the Constitution doesn't say anything about it. It leaves it up to democratic choice. Some states prohibited it and some states didn't. What Roe versus Wade said was that no state can prohibit it. That's simply not in the Constitution. So that's Antonin Scalia, who was a well-formed Catholic, a brilliant lawyer, but he was a legal positivist. And so, you know, I think he was also wrong constitutionally in that the Constitution doesn't say anything about it. It, of course it does. The Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment refer to the right to life, and due process and equal protection. And so, the problem is we have on the one hand the conservatives. This would be the tool that we would need to use in terms of getting, you know, getting the Federalist Society list that President Trump has been drawing from. They all agree with this position. The opposite side is another Catholic attorney, Anthony Kennedy, who is completely off the rails, but he represents kind of the opposite, the second option. And his famous quote is that at the heart of liberty is a right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. And that's radical individualism, that's godlessness, that's secularism. And so, neither one of these options is good. So what are we to do? Here's another quote. I should say I'm going to put this this whole presentation, because it has a lot of quotes and I don't want to read them all and bore you. It's going to be on the Personhood website, Dan, if we can do that, and then you can draw it for reference if you want to for resources or talks or anything that you want. We'll just put it on the website at personhood.org. So how does a legal positivist deal with an unjust law? Antonin Scalia was actually asked this question at a forum by a student who stood up and said, you know, if you had been in Nazi Germany and the law of the Reich said that Jews weren't full citizens, weren't full persons, how would you have implemented and interpreted that law? And so for that, I'd like to take you to, for the answer to that, to this this movie, The Judgment at Nuremberg. It's a famous movie. Some of you older folks probably recognize it. Some of you younger folks probably should watch it. So here's a clip.
The defendant, Friedrich Hofstadter, may address the tribunal.
I have served my country throughout my life, and in whatever position I was assigned to, in faithfulness, with a pure heart and without malice. I followed the concept that I believe to be the highest in my profession. The concept that says to sacrifice one's own sense of justice to the authoritative legal order. To ask only what the law is, and not to ask whether or not it is also justice. As a judge, I could do no other. I believe your honors will find me, and millions of Germans like me who believe they were doing their duty to their country, to be not guilty.
So he basically said he had, his legal view was that he had to sacrifice his conscience. He had to put his conscience aside when he was being a judge. And I believe that that's what Antonin Scalia and probably all of the judges that we consider conservatives and pro-life, that's what they believe. Maybe Justice Thomas, there might be sort of a small chance that he leaves an opening for the natural law and for conscience, but even he has some quotes that, that espouse this view. And I'm afraid if I were a judge, which of course I will never be, you know, get to the Supreme Court because my views are too direct on this. If I were a judge, I'd probably get kicked out in no time. But what I would have in mind is that this same scene, I think, will be replayed at Judgment Day. Not, you know, not in a fictional Hollywood sense, but when we each are before our Lord. And so I think I would want to put that ahead of a legal theory and a sense of duty to that theory. So I think the solution is in a return to the natural law. And so what is the natural law? I gave this talk last week and there was a lawyer in the audience and he said, well, you know, aren't you basically saying that you want the judges to become legislators? You want them to be able to, you know, write into law their own opinion. And that's not it at all. I think, you know, the natural law, is not in, I heard somebody give this example, which I think is a good one. The natural law doesn't dictate what speed you have to drive or on what side of the road you have to drive. That's positive law. The natural law dictates the reason why you have a speed limit. It's that you have to protect the safety of other people. And so natural law is an idea that undergirds your positive law. And we can reach that through reason. We don't need theological arguments. People can reach that just through pure reason. And I think that it's the duty of judges to exercise their conscience, to inject their conscience, and to search for natural law reasons, because it's really the only way to combat an unjust law. Otherwise, you're just like that German judge. So let's see. I want to get to some of the other sections. So a depressing part of my talk here is you hear a lot, especially from young people, that the pro-life movement is stronger. More young people are pro-life than ever. There are even some polls that say that young people consider themselves to be more pro-life than they did 30 years ago, 45 years ago. But the truth is that there's a lot of confusion. The pro-life movement hasn't been teaching what it actually means to be pro-life. So it's kind of like, you know, I don't associate being pro-choice with being a liberated woman. I think that's kind of worn off a little bit. And so, you know, more people are likely to say that they're pro-life. But when you actually look at it and you ask them, you know, when should abortion be illegal in all circumstances? You know, should it be illegal in some circumstances, et cetera? Here is from 1975, legal under any circumstances, 21%. May of 2017, legal under any circumstances, 29%. So it has gone up. And I think that's undeniable. I think it's an incredibly tough battle, and we're losing it. Anybody who denies that, I think, is not being honest, is not looking around, and they're probably trying to fundraise to, you know, to say what a great job they're doing. But the truth is we're not doing a good enough job. We haven't identified the root cause. We keep God out of the argument because we think we can reach that secular middle. And so this has led to 45 years in the desert and to declining numbers of support. There is an argument, by the way, that I don't know if you've seen Michael New. He's a statistician and he's done good work, but I think he has severe flaws in his arguments. He says that when you look at the incremental pro-life laws, what I would call morally compromised laws, and you look at how many of these laws have been passed in states, it correlates to a decrease in abortion. However, there's a problem with that argument. For example, Hawaii has the greatest reduction in reported abortions, and they have no pro-life laws of any type, whether they're compromised or not. Also, the definition of abortion is changing. Abortifacient contraception is not considered abortion, and so there's more and more over-the-counter use of the morning-after pill and abortifacient contraception. And so, you know, it's hard to really know exactly whether the rate is decreasing. And as we know, the very honest industry of abortion self-reports, and I would imagine that for tax purposes they might want to say that they're doing less business than they're actually doing, so they don't have to pay as much, and so that they can, you know, they can say that abortion is becoming safe, legal, and rare and all that junk. So I just think those statistics are negated by what we can see around us in the society and the general decline. So we get to Hellerstedt. In 2016, this was the first opinion in over a decade that the Supreme Court came down with. And just think about that. 10 years between Supreme Court opinions. So if your whole strategy is incremental change by trying to get the Supreme Court to slowly chip away, it took 10 years for them, and we actually went backwards. So Hellerstedt dealt with two Texas laws. It was admitting privileges and then medical standards, and they knocked them both down and basically went back. Here, I think they were being intellectually honest. They went back to that argument, and they said anything that limits a woman's access to abortion is going to be unconstitutional, because you're dealing with restricting a fundamental right versus, on the other hand, you know, what benefit? It's interesting, but the majority opinion doesn't mention the unborn child even once. That's because they don't recognize the unborn child. He or she is not a person to them. So they're always going to see anything that limits abortion in any degree, no matter how morally compromised, according to Hellerstedt, is going to be unconstitutional. And for, they had a procedural ruling in there, too, that I'm actually not going to get into. But Hellerstedt was a big step back for the pro-life movement from Gonzalez, which was the partial birth abortion case. Here, I'd like to introduce a term. I don't know how many of you know the word, the term a Pyrrhic victory is when you win a victory that's so costly that it's actually a defeat. So you could win a battle that actually sets you back in the war because you lose most of your troops. And I think that's kind of what the pro-life movement has been doing over and over and over, is trying to win these battles that undermine our own case. For example, you know, with Rebecca Kiesling and her ministry, always throwing the child conceived in rape under the bus, and at the same time trying to maintain that we believe all life is sacred. Well, if we do, then why are we accepting the death penalty for the innocent party in those cases? So, anyways, so that's what I think is a Pyrrhic victory. Check out this first 49 seconds of oral argument of the partial birth abortion case, which was something that cost us like 10 years in passing laws and hundreds of millions of dollars in money spent to get people elected. And this is the result.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Congress held six hearings over four different Congresses and heard from dozens of witnesses in determining that partial birth abortions are never medically necessary, pose health risks, and should be banned. Under familiar principles of deference to congressional fact-finding, those determinations should be upheld as long as they represent reasonable inferences based on substantial evidence in the congressional record. That standard is amply satisfied here. The evidence before Congress was clear that partial birth abortions were never medically necessary and that safe alternatives were always available such that no woman would be prevented from terminating her pregnancy.
Sorry about being so redundant there, but that was considered a great victory for the pro-life movement. If that's not setting your bar incredibly low, I don't know what is. Not a single, by the admission of the pro-life solicitor general arguing the case, not even a single baby would be saved because alternatives were always available to kill that child. So if that, and again, that goes back to that decision in Roe versus Wade. It's a catch-22. You can't win. The only way you win a court case is by saying that you're not actually trying to save any babies. So why are we even engaged in this argument under Roe versus Wade? I think we shouldn't be. I think we should be challenging it directly. We have two examples. We have two examples right now of groups that are challenging federal law, and they're doing it brazenly. Sanctuary cities. There's clear federal supremacy, and San Francisco and other cities, they don't care because they have an agenda and they're going to, you know, they're invested. Marijuana. States are legalizing marijuana. It's clearly illegal under federal law. Again, they don't care. They're actually going in the direction that they want to go, and they're advancing. And so, you know, potheads and people who support sanctuary cities have more conviction than the pro-life movement. That is the truth. I'm sorry. Okay, this is what a real victory sounds like. And probably most of you, even most attorneys in the room, have not heard this. It was a gem that I found when I was researching this book that we wrote for Personhood. Let me see if it's...
I think I could suggest to the court to contract...
Sorry, let me introduce it first. This is oral argument from another case in 1977. It's a case involving the refusal of the city of St. Louis to allow abortions to be done in their city hospitals, and by the Catholic hospital also. They joined together. It wasn't actually implementing a law. It was just implementing the policy of the mayor. So then, you know, pro-lifers didn't even have to spend money lobbying and compromising to get politicians to do anything. The mayor just said, look, I'm not going to allow abortions to be done in city hospitals. And the Catholic Church supported them in St. Louis. And this was the argument that was made by the attorney arguing the case. Compare it in your mind to what you heard on the partial birth abortion case.
The universe of childbearing with abortion, I think the judicial point of view is required to be different in a case such as this than it has been in any of the other type of cases. Your Honor's attention in the abortion cases, Roe and Doe and Planned Parenthood versus Central Missouri and some of the others, has been centered towards abortion. This case involves something far more broader than abortion. And I think that by respectfully suggesting these things to your honors, that it may be of help in your honors analysis. The court will certainly recall that childbearing is a consummation of a person. It's a value of infinite worth, of event of incalculable consequences. Generation is its process and life is its end. Abortion is just the opposite. It's the prevention of the birth of a person. It's the obliteration of the possibility of a person. It's the interference with life, and death or non-existence is its end. Childbearing is a natural process. The attitude of the community, including the medical science that is associated with, in part, is to support and assist childbearing, not to cause this natural phenomenon. Abortion, on the other hand, is an interruption and deliberate termination of this natural process and thwarts it. In objective logical extension, childbearing is essential for the continuation of the human race, the family, the community, the state, and the nation. Abortion is, in a objective philosophical sense, genocidal.
Okay. That's the argument that we should be making at the Supreme Court. Not that abortion was always available. That's not an argument. That's a pro-abortion argument. That's a pro-life argument. And in fact, they won this case. The Supreme Court, it's the only area that pro-lifers have actually had success, legitimate success, is in preventing funds, some funds, from going to abortion. And that came through this type of action, and it came in 76, 77 with the Hyde Amendment and with these cases. Since then, we have had no progress. We've had 40 years in the desert since then. And I should like to mention, I'll name names again, but the National Right to Life Committee, their pro-life legal action project, was initiated in 1977, which was right after all the progress was made. Since then, they haven't done diddly squat. We haven't advanced at all. And so how are we gaining? Why are we saying that, you know, we should do these incremental changes because it's all we can do? Well, no, you're not getting anywhere. You're just undermining our actual basis for making arguments. And we're not getting any victories. Since 1977, we haven't had any actual victories. Let me tell you what we have on the books in terms of federal law that has cost us so much time and so much effort.
They say that
I don't know where it is. Well, I'll just tell you. We have the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which says that you can protect you should protect children after a failed abortion, but it specifically excludes abortion from any protection for the preborn, so you can still kill the child. So really, it's basically preventing infanticide. And by the way, it's not applied. My sister's a neonatologist, and she tells me that at her hospital, they leave children to die from exposure all the time. They're not afraid of this. It's not being implemented. So forget it. You know, toss that one out. You have the Lacey and Connors law that when you commit a crime on federal property, which is pretty reduced, then you have to charge, and a baby dies in the womb, then you can charge with two crimes. But again, it specifically excludes abortion. So how is that even a pro-life law? The third one is the Hyde Amendment, which was successful to a degree. It started out, it was introduced in 74 by a legislator. Immediately, the bishops actually came in. The Catholic bishops asked for a life of the mother exception to be put in. once Henry Hyde allowed that, then rape and incest was put in there. And so the Hyde Amendment works to a certain degree, but it's quite limited, and there's a million ways, as everybody who works in legislation knows, that they get around it and they still get money. Sorry about the depressing State of the Union address here. Let's see. So I'd like to compare the approach that we've taken a little bit to slavery, because I think the comparison is quite to the point. With slavery, it was not resolved by outlawing the trade, the slave trade. It wasn't resolved by limiting the practice geographically when they tried the different compromises. And it was not resolved by maintaining the status quo. Unfortunately, slavery was resolved by brute force and war and death. And by abolitionists not ceding an inch. And so abortion, again, it's not resolved by regulating the practice and reducing the incidence. It's not resolved by limiting it geographically, a state-by-state approach. It's not resolved by maintaining the status quo, obviously, because we have abortion on demand. And here's, again, from that same speech by Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Okay, so even if we're in the make-believe world that these laws that include rape and incest exceptions were to pass, they're not. If they passed, they wouldn't be enforced, because pro-life laws are never enforced. But even then, we know that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so, Rebecca Kiesling would be dead if they hadn't had legal abortion. And that's, I think, what Martin Luther King was talking about. And that's why we have to oppose these compromises. It's what Michael Voris was talking about. It's that poison that gets in there and poisons everything else. Here's another issue, the life of the mother, something I mentioned the bishops wanted in there. You can design a life of the mother clause that basically spells out the principle of double effect, but it's really not necessary, okay? You actually have a history, both modern history in countries that outlaw abortion and our own American history where abortion was illegal, not one case ever for a person, a doctor, or a woman being prosecuted because of the death of a baby during a medical procedure to try to help the mom. Not one. So really, it's subterfuge. It's just that way to get us to open the door to say, intentional killing once in a while is okay. And here I'd like to talk about two illustrative cases that don't have to do with abortion. They deal with the exact same subject. And one of them is a really interesting case that everybody that goes to law school reads. It's the Queen versus Dudley and Stevens. It's a case of cannibalism on the high seas. And so the cast here is the cabin boy, Richard Parker. There's a captain, Tom Dudley, and the sailors, Edwin Stephen and Edmund Brooks. And what happened in this case was that their ship went down. They were on a small boat in the middle of the ocean, and they managed to survive first by eating two cans of turnips that they had. They spread that out over like a week. Then they got a turtle and sacrificed it and ate even the shell. And then eventually they just ran out. And the cabin boy had drunk seawater, and so he got sick. And so immediately the sick one became the putative sacrificial victim for the rest to stay alive. And they debated amongst themselves. One of the guys said, no, I think it was Brooks, who said, no, I'm not going to do it, but he kind of went to the other side of the boat, and eventually they were in desperation. They slit the throat of the cabin boy and ate him, and actually survived. All three of them survived. So they got back to port, and they were tried. And there was this sort of unwritten law of the sea that they thought, this was okay to do because the circumstances were so dire. And so this came down to the Supreme Court of England, and they issued a decision, which is long, and I'm not going to read because I'm running out of time. But I want you guys, if you can, download the presentation tomorrow and read this. I'll just read you a quick quote. This is the Lord Coleridge, Chief Justice of England, 1884. He says, though the law and morality are not the same, and many things may be immoral which are not necessarily illegal, yet the absolute divorce of law from morality would be of fatal consequence. We've done that. We've accepted that in our legal system. Further on down, he says, who is to be the judge of this sort of necessity? By what measure is the comparative value of lives to be measured? Is it to be strength or intellect or what? It is plain that the principal leaves to him who is to profit by it to determine the necessity which will justify him in deliberately taking another's life to save his own. In this case, the weakest, the youngest, the most unresisting was chosen. In this case, and in every case, by the way. Was it more necessary to kill him than any of the grown men? The answer must be no. And so this sets down the principle that necessity can never justify murder. If somebody puts a gun to your head and says, kill your neighbor, it's not a justification. If you do it, you're guilty of murder. And so necessity, no matter how dire, is never justification for murder because we hold this principle of the sanctity of life. The other case is the case of regarding A, Siamese twins, conjoined twins. And so this was a very Catholic family in England, and they had Siamese twins. They were both going to die. They were very young. And they were both going to die if they were not separated. If they were separated, one of them had more of an option to live. The doctor said there was like a 90% chance that she would live, but the other one would die. And so this actually came to the courts in England. And the decision came down with three different theories. One was a theory of self-defense, that it was a legitimate act because you were acting in self-defense. You weren't proactively killing somebody by separating them. The other one was an argument of necessity that kind of went a little bit against that previous case of the cannibalism. And the third was, I think, closer to our Catholic teaching, which is looking at the intentionality of the doctor's actions and the fact that their intention was not to murder the less favored Siamese twin, but to separate them and try to save as many lives as they could. So this applies directly to abortion. And as we can see here, there are three theories that the judges all adopted to justify these actions. I think the same case would be with abortion. We wouldn't have to put any life of the mother exception. If you say all life is sacred, if you protect all innocent human life, this legal system will find a way to deal with these very, very, very rare, they almost never happen, but very rare situations where, you know, one has to die for the other to survive without having to say, you know, we strip every unborn child of their right to life, which is what we have right now. I skipped one thing that I wanted, one depressing thing that I wanted you guys to see. Here. This is, we hear so often that, you know, we just need that one extra judge. And I want you to hear two. How much time do I have? Okay, just this one video. Two clips. One is Justice Scalia. The other one's Judge Gorsuch, both of whom I believe are good men, but they both adhere to this legal positivism. So
they say that the Equal Protection Clause requires that you treat a helpless human being that's still in the womb the way you treat other human beings. When the Constitution says that persons are entitled to equal protection of the laws, I think it clearly means walking around persons. Walking around persons.
Okay. Now, this is just this last year.
Words matter. The judge's job is to follow the words that are in the law, not replace them with those that aren't.
There is a statement which you made in that book, which has been often quoted, and I want to make sure that I quote it accurately here today. It relates to the taking of life. And I quote, "The intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong." That was a statement that you included in your book, correct?
I believe so.
I believe so, too. How could you square that statement with legal abortion?
Senator, as the book explains, the Supreme Court of the United States has held in Roe versus Wade that a fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment. And the book explains that.
Do you accept that?
That's the law of the land. I accept the law of the land, Senator, yes.
Thank you for that clarification.
The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights.
A fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment.
I'm sorry to be a downer, but there, in my mind, there wasn't that much difference between what Hillary was saying and what Gorsuch was saying. That's how far we have to go. And we have to focus in on this issue of personhood. It's there whether we like it or not. It's a vehicle that was used to legalize abortion. Until we change it, we're not going to be able to end abortion. And let me leave you with what we can do. I think there are some things that we can do. So first one is pray. I think that's our strongest point. Let's not leave that out ever. If any organization tells you not to do it, just, you know, refuse. Walk away. We have to use that weapon. It's our strongest weapon. I think never accept this compromise with intrinsic evil. If we open the door for a compromise, the compromise is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. We're dealing with a fundamental truth. You cannot compromise with truth, with fundamental truth. Encourage peaceful disobedience of unjust laws. I personally fully support the Red Rose Rescue and all of the peaceful disobedience. I think we need it. We need social tension. We can't just have business as usual, and we can't be, you know, nice and polite and just do our little red roses to legislators and honor them at banquets. No, they have to fear us a little bit, and they don't. Another one is encourage legislation that nullifies the Supreme Court's attack on the right to life and equal protection of the preborn. This is personhood. This is a human life amendment. It's something that, unfortunately, a lot of the mainstream groups don't support. Shift our focus from federal elected officials to committed prosecutors and state executives who are willing to intercede on behalf of the preborn. That case where I played the audio from 1977, nobody had to vote that guy in. Well, he was a mayor, but they didn't lobby him in terms of a specific law. He was there. He made the right decision, and it got all the way to the Supreme Court and got a great result. Phil Klein, who you might remember, Attorney General of Kansas, the only person who has attempted to prosecute Planned Parenthood for them breaking laws. We have over 1,000 pro-life laws on the books. We never try to execute and implement those laws. And so they pass. Sometimes we feel good about it, and then they just sit there. And we never go after them. So let's start doing that. We don't need more compromised pro-life laws. Let's start implementing the ones we have. Then the last one I think is the most important one. Demand a return to God-given rights and not to man-made law as a basis of law. Bring God back into American cultural, social, political, and legal life as the highest authority on moral issues. And the best way we can do this, I think, is by educating our own families and our own communities around us and having our churches speak out, getting involved. It's a long road to hoe, so I don't want to be pessimistic, but I also don't want to be falsely optimistic. This is tough. We're fighting a really, really hard battle here. So thank you so much for coming.